My name is Jake Walker with the Eagle newspaper. And my first question is, in the first chapter of your book, early on, you kind of talked about how there were too many people in Washington that were worried more about their principal objectives rather than public service. Now, was there a certain time where you noticed that was becoming more of a problem, or is that always something that you kind of looked out for?
Well, it was something that I always was on the lookout for, but I think it really didn't come home to me fully until I became Secretary of Defense and saw members of Congress in particular trying to protect their parochial interests in their district. Every contract was sacrosanct, and no matter how wasteful a defense program might be, they would fight to the death to try and keep it, just because it was jobs in their district or in their state. And we had a number of programs that obviously needed to be cut. And I ran into significant resistance. I'll just give you one example. So we've got a presidential helicopter. I used to joke with President Obama. I went in and I said, I've got some good news and some bad news. The good news is we've got a new helicopter for you that's being developed, and you can get in it. You don't have to stoop over. And it's got a galley where you can cook up a meal in the middle of a nuclear war. The bad news is that helicopter is going to cost you $1 billion apiece. And we still had representatives in the districts where that helicopter would have been built that were prepared to defend it to the death. So it was that kind of thing that really began to get under my skin, because it was, and the overall result of that parochialism is that the military will tell you today they have 25% more facilities and bases and so on in the United States than they need. But the Congress won't let them shut them down. So it's one of those many areas of the Congress talks about waste in the Department of Defense all the time, and there is waste. But part of that waste is the result of their actions.
Thank you. I guess I'll go next. I'm Kristen Gilfus from KVTX, the CBS station here. Why did you decide now was the time to write this book?
Well, first of all, in practical terms, when I met with the publisher after I retired, I always thought of it as a two-book package. So I have, from the time before I even began to write Duty, I was committed to writing this book. And I just felt like, at the end, having led these three very different organizations, that there were lessons about how you can lead change and reform that were applicable across the board and to every other organization as well. And I didn't feel that there was really anything out there that had been written by anybody who'd actually done it, as opposed to academics or others, on how you lead change in big or in any organization. So I was pretty well committed to doing it from the beginning.
Mr. Secretary, from a leadership perspective, there are obviously going to be people who are maybe future leaders that would read your book and take something away from it, maybe even people that are running for the highest office in the country. What would you hope that somebody who reads your book, pursuing that position or any other, would take away from it?
Well, I think there are two aspects to the book. One is the sort of the practical aspect of it. You're the new leader of an organization. And it doesn't matter whether it's got three people or 3 million or an entire government. And you basically have been chosen to fix an underperforming or broken structure, organization, bureaucracy, whatever you call it. And it's your first day on the job. What do you do? What do you do? And so the book is a fairly practical approach to how you move through that. And frankly, this is the first time that I've ever written about my experience here at Texas A&M. And I talk about the importance of listening to people, listening to faculty, listening to staff, listening to students, listening to regents, listening to alumni, former students, listening to a variety of people, figuring out where the deficiencies are, why isn't the place moving as fast or as far forward as we would like. I had the advantage here at A&M of Vision 2020, which was kind of a blueprint. But then how do you devise an agenda? How do you devise a strategy to implement the agenda? And then how do you implement it? That's the practical side of the book. The other side of the book are techniques for how you deal with stakeholders, communities, alumni or former students, athletic fans, retired military, all the people who have influence and a say in the affairs of an organization, and how you deal with the media, and how you deal with regulators or overseers or boards of regents. But then finally, there is the piece about people, and the line in the book is that people, not systems, implement change. So how do you empower people? How do you delegate authority, empower people, and hold people accountable for performance? And then there's a whole chapter on the personal characteristics that I believe are necessary for someone who intends to lead change. So it kind of covers the gamut.
Mr. Gates, Jackie Patel, KIC, the NBC affiliate, wanted to know, should there be classes in our educational system for leadership?
Well, one of the points that I make in the book and that I'll make in my remarks today is that I think you can, I draw a distinction between leadership and management. And you can, through education, make somebody a good manager. And every organization needs good managers, finance, logistics, human relations, you name it. But I argue in the book that leadership, especially leadership of change, is more about the heart than the head. And I talk about one of the things that I'll mention in my remarks this morning. Dwight Eisenhower writing to his son in 1943 about the characteristics of a leader. And that, and he says it's devotion to duty, sincerity, good cheer, and I argue, and fairness. And I say in the book, those are not subjects that are taught in school. And if you don't like people, if you don't respect people, if you think you're superior to other people, you're not going to be a good leader. And I have the statement in the book and in the remarks that just because you're high on the organizational ladder and can tell people what to do doesn't make you a leader, just a boss. So a leader is somebody, the definition of a leader is someone who shows the way, who guides. So it's all about the future when you're talking about a real leader, it seems to me. And I think that's very hard to teach. In a university or a college or company program.
Where do you develop those leadership traits? If it's hard to teach in an educational setting, how do you get that?
Well, I think it's experience. It's role models. I say, I open the last chapter of the book by saying my first leadership position was as a patrol leader in a Boy Scout troop in Wichita, Kansas. And nothing teaches leadership skills like trying to get a bunch of 11 and 12-year-old boys to do what they don't want to do. And you can't make them do it, and you're only a year older than they are. So it's experience. It's watching other people and learning along the way, it seems to me. But I go back to the fact that it all has to do, I think, successful leaders. It is a matter of the heart. It is how you look at other people. Can you empathize? Can you motivate? Can you inspire? And I think those are hard things to teach.
I was wondering if you can think of an example of a public institution that best exemplifies the qualities that you advocate for in your book right now.
Well, in what respect? In terms of an organization that's continuing, continually reforming and
yes,
changing? Well, I think, you know, I mean, I would say that my hope is that that continues to be the case with Texas A&M. We made a lot of changes from 2002 to 2007. And one of the things that I talk about in the book is that the reform and improvement is not a one-time event. It is a continuing process. Trotsky called it permanent revolution. Not sure you want to quote Trotsky at Texas A&M, but that's really what it's all about. It is the reality that, and I talk about it in the book, you go through the original agenda for change, and then you have to sit down and say, okay, now what next? Where do we tackle next? So when I took over as Director of Central Intelligence in November of 1991, we were 6 weeks away from the collapse of the Soviet Union. How do I reorient the entire intelligence community to deal with a world that is completely different than we have faced for the last 45 years? And at one point, in the spring of 1992, I had 24 different task forces underway. The longest deadline on any of them was 3 months. And we pretty much had implemented everything. by the summer of 92, I came back from my summer vacation in September of 1992, and I had a yellow tablet full of all the things we were going to do next. And I write in the book, as long as you can keep filling up your yellow tablet with things that need to be done, then you're probably, it's okay for you to stay in the job. But once your tablet's empty, then it's time to go home. So I would say for all institutions, even those that have done a lot of reform, that it's an unending process. And that's kind of tiring to people at times, but that's how you keep improving. And one of the I use some examples from the private sector. That you take a company like GE or IBM or some of the new companies like Apple and others, they are constantly reinventing themselves. And they are hungry. They know that that the world is changing, and they have to change and try and stay in front of them. So if the world were static, you could stop reforming and changing. But part of reform is also meeting new challenges. And so I think that this is a process that just goes on and on.
Last question, guys.
You're standing on the stage again in the facility of one of the presidents that you served. How does George H.W. Bush fit into the narrative that you're presenting in this book?
Well, I think that if you read the chapter on the personal characteristics of a leader, practically every sentence you can say, yeah, that was Bush 41. In terms of the way you treat people, in terms of being willing to surround yourself with people you think are smarter than you are, and listen to them, not necessarily take their advice wholesale, but pick and choose. Treating people with dignity and respect, including the people who have to deliver the mission and the decision-making process. I think pretty much every sentence of that chapter, I would apply to 41.
Are there 41s left in politics these days?
Well, if there are, I can't see.